Hello, this is David Naylor, and welcome to the audio commentary for A View to a Kill. On this audio commentary, we will be joined by director John Glenn and many members of the cast and crew. The stories which you're about to hear reflect the personal recollections and opinions of those who provided the interviews. Some comments have been edited for time and clarity. They are not meant to provide the definitive history of the film. A View to a Kill, the 14th James Bond film, is the only 007 movie that begins with a disclaimer. Although Zorin sounds like a rather unusual name, producer Michael Wilson recalls that there was a high-tech company in Silicon Valley with a name that sounded very similar. At the time of the film's release, it was also reported that the disclaimer was to prevent legal action from a fashion designer named Zorin, spelled Zoran. In any event, unlike Max Zorin, neither the fashion designer nor the high-tech company were intent on world domination. The pre-credit sequence of A View to a Kill was filmed in three locations: the Pirspalu Glacier in Switzerland for the ski and snowmobile action, Lake Jökulsárlón in Iceland for shots of the model helicopters and Bond's iceberg-shaped submarine, and Pinewood for close-ups of Roger Moore. The ski and monoski action was directed by Bond veteran Willy Bogner, a former Olympic skier who had his first 007 assignment filming ski action for 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service. For the exciting ski action that opens A View to a Kill, Willy Bogner wanted to begin the scene with James Bond leaping from one side of a frozen crevasse to another to make his escape. Initially, the scene was going to be filmed in Scotland, but Bogner encountered unexpected difficulties, as he now recalls.
We started working on that with a whole crew from Scotland in creating these kind of ledges, and it was a very hot spring at the time. And the crevasse opened. So at the end, when we were finished building these ledges, they were too far apart for a stunt guy to reach the other time. So after 5 weeks of work, we had to start from scratch, go higher up where the temperature was lower, and start the whole work again. But finally we got it.
Several different stunt performers double for 007 in the scene. Martin Grace and Mick Coyne stand in for Bond in the shots filmed in Iceland, while John Eaves and Tom Sims sub for 007 in the shots filmed in Switzerland. Willy Bogner had just made a film of his own called Fire and Ice before beginning work on A View to a Kill. He and his ski action unit spent a month on the Pirspalu Glacier using storyboards as well as the script to guide them in filming scenes that could intercut seamlessly with John Glenn's shots of the principal actors. The shot of Bond using a monoski to glide across the lake was a Bogner idea, implemented by champion snowboarder Steve Lincoln. Director John Glenn came up with the idea of using the Beach Boys song, California Girls, to give a humorous spin to the scene. John Glenn now recalls filming the sequence.
Here we go again with an exciting action scene to start the ball rolling. One of the places we'd looked at was Iceland, which is a pretty new country. I mean, it only came out of the sea about 50,000 years ago, I think. It is an incredible terrain. You have such a mixture of volcanic eruptions and steaming cauldrons and glaciers and the sort of lakes that are continually filling with icebergs, which are a piece of great huge chunks of ice that come off the glacier. I went down there with some of the technicians and we did a feasibility study of actually shooting in this lake. It was great for us because we could mount a camera on the far side of the lake on a bridge where it went out to the open sea. And depending on the wind direction, the icebergs would drift backwards and forwards. And we got in a rubber boat and we explored all these areas. And there are natural caverns in the icebergs, which are absolutely unbelievable. They look like cathedrals inside. And I spent the best part of a day going around and clambering on these ice floes and what have you. But I didn't see any actual pieces of ice fall off the glacier on this particular visit, which was what I had in my mind for the opening shot. the local guide said to me, you were very lucky that you didn't, so we probably should have taken him with us. And we would probably never have seen all these beautiful things. But in the event, we decided to use a sequence. It appealed to me, as I say, it was a very strong opening.
Mary Stavin, a former Miss World from Sweden, portrays the pilot of the iceberg camouflage launch. Stavin had previously appeared in Octopussy. Production supervisor Anthony Way recalls location scouting.
Beautiful Kill, I was production manager. So I did the recce to Iceland and set it up. And I didn't do the shoot. We left a second unit shooting up there. Iceland is an amazing country. Reykjavik, the capital, is a fascinating town. And we flew on a small plane from Reykjavik, and we circled over that amazing glacier that comes down into the lake and the ice flows, which was going to be our location. And then we drove to the lake and climbed aboard large rubber dinghies with outboards on and life jackets. And you're now driving on this lake through these giant icebergs. And they're enormous. They've broken off the glacier and they slowly float out to sea, through the lake and out to sea. It was quite frightening because occasionally these giant icebergs, thousands of tons of ice, they turn over because they melt away at the bottom. It takes years. And then they flip. And they flip very suddenly. You have something like a giant block of flats. It suddenly turns over in front of your eyes. So later on, when we had crew shooting up there, Arthur Worcester would have three or four cameras out. So there was always one or two on top of one of these ice floes. And you never knew which one was going to go. So the local safety guides used to warn you if they thought this one was a liable, was a possible.
A View to a Kill marked the third consecutive James Bond film to be directed by John Glenn. Glenn, who had been editor and second unit director of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, as well as one of the two second unit directors on The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, began his career as a dubbing editor before moving into film editing for such television series as Danger Man and The Avengers. Publicist Jerry Giroux remembers working with director John Glenn.
John Glenn is someone I knew from the point of time when he was a film editor. The publicity office on Moonraker was next door to where the film editing was. We became very friendly. We got to know each other extremely well. A very fine, nice human being who I think contributed greatly to five different Bonds. There's no question that Cubby Broccoli gave John the chance of his life to step in to directing after his highly successful career as a second unit director and a film editor. And I think John paid Cubby back in spades by the job he did on five Bonds.
After making an appearance in Chariots of Fire, Carol Ashby won a role in Octopussy as one of Octopussy's girls. She returned in 1985 for A View to a Kill, when John Glenn called her and invited her aboard. Ashby remembers John Glenn.
What I like about John Glenn, he's quite relaxed about everything, you know? He makes it look like we're just going out and we're just going to have some fun and whatever. He's a great action-adventure director. And he's great with the girls, he's just very relaxed with the girls. And what's quite funny, that sometimes sort of people come along and it could be big stars, and I said, who is he? You know, he's just very unspoiled, I suppose, really. And there's a side to him that's also quite boyish, you know, like a little boy. And I think that's probably why he loves doing his action-adventure. That's why he's so good at it. He's very easygoing with a lovely sense of humour. We've had lots of fun with him.
David Yip appears in A View to a Kill as Chuck Lee, Bond's CIA liaison in San Francisco. Yip found working with John Glenn a very pleasant and satisfying experience, as he recalls here.
I think the important thing about direction is actually he is the focal point. And I think they're relaxed and they have a happy feeling about the place. And they know what they're doing. I think that permeates out to everybody else. And I always felt, in terms of John Glenn, that he knew what he was doing, he was in control, and that he let you get on with it. And that was it.
Roger Moore makes his seventh and final appearance as James Bond in A View to a Kill. David Yip recalls working with Roger Moore.
As a child, I'd watch Roger Moore do The Saint and all those things. He's a very typical English hero. I thought he brought a wonderful dryness, actually, to the part. He was a very sweet guy.
A View to a Kill also marks the final appearance of Lois Maxwell as Miss Moneypenny. Co-producer and co-screenwriter Michael Wilson remembers Lois Maxwell.
Lois Maxwell's been a wonderful, staunch supporter and great cast member over all the years we used her. She was, you know, it was sad to see her go, but I think she was of Roger's era. They sort of made a fine pair together. It was just one of those situations when you cast a new Bond, the chemistry has to be right with the new Moneypenny to make it all work.
Lois Maxwell played the part of Miss Moneypenny in 14 films over a period of 23 years. Another long-time cast member was Desmond Llewellyn, who played Q. John Richardson recalls the challenges of creating devices such as Q's dog-like robot, Snooper.
Those things are always difficult because they get very fiddly. Mechanically, you always seem to end up stretching things to the nth degree. And, you know, because the head has to come up on a long stalk, it ends up putting a lot of pressure on one point, which is the point that always breaks. And it's, you know, it's because it's small and compact, it's very difficult to fix something like that quickly and easily. And the last thing you want on a Bond film or any other film is something that's going to break down in the middle of shooting and you're going to have everybody standing around waiting while you fix it. So the nightmares that go into constructing these things to try and make sure that those embarrassing moments don't happen can be a very consuming thing when you've got 4 million other things to get on with at the same time. Private defense contractors came up with this,
a chip totally impervious. Desmond Llewellyn made his first appearance as Q in 1963's From Russia with Love. One of the most beloved cast members of the James Bond films, Llewellyn acted opposite 5 different James Bonds: Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, and Pierce Brosnan in 17 007 films. His final appearance in the role was in 1999's The World Is Not Enough. Though typecast as the gadget master of British intelligence, in real life, Llewellyn was not mechanically inclined. Robert Brown portrays M in A View to a Kill, a role he assumed beginning with the previous film, Octopussy, and would play 2 more times in The Living Daylights and License to Kill. Born in the Hebrides Islands, Brown had worked with Roger Moore in the TV series Ivanhoe. His first 007 film appearance came in The Spy Who Loved Me as Admiral Hargreaves. A View to a Kill was filmed at many locations, generally considered difficult, if not impossible, to obtain permission for filming. But co-producer Albert R. Cubby Broccoli was able to overcome almost any obstacle, as second unit director Arthur Worcester recalls.
We went to Ascot, and they said, no, we never have never have any film work at Ascot. No, Royal Ascot, no, it's not possible. Go back to Cubby.
Okay.
And 3 days later, or 2 days later, he calls you into a meeting, we go back to Ascot, and we speak to the same people, and we're welcomed with open arms. I mean, that's a producer.
Patrick McNee portrays Sir Godfrey Tibbet, a horse trainer in A View to a Kill. Most famous for his role of the debonair agent John Steed on the popular television series The Avengers, McNee was already quite familiar with the race course at Ascot.
My dad was a racehorse trainer, and I probably have visited and worked at and ridden out horses on every race course in England. Ascot is only famous because everybody goes there in these clothes at the special time of year. And the fact that they chose it to do the racing was fun because it was based on horses.
Grace Jones, already a well-established nightclub performer, collaborated with her personal designer, Azadina Alea, and the film's costume designer, Emma Porteous, to create her look for the film, which she described as striking. It bears a resemblance to something out of a Walt Disney movie. Here's Michael Wilson's comments on Jones's wardrobe.
The problem for us is that there's a big difference between clothes that are made by designers for runway and there's ones that are made for movie business. In the movie business, we have to have lots of copies of them, especially in the action stuff. Because, you know, Grace Jones did some of her stunts, but for instance, jumping off the Eiffel Tower, she'd run up the stairs and then make a leap off, and then we'd have stuntman do a sort of wider shot of a big leap, and then we'd have, of course, the jump off the Eiffel Tower with the parachute. So it took lots of different stuntmen, you know, and then she had to land on top of a boat, and then there was more stuntmen doing different stuff. So that one costume required many copies in many different sizes to fit lots of different people. So in arranging the costumes in a Bond film, by and large we have to use people that are familiar with making costumes for the movie business. But the designs can be done by a designer.
While on location, Reckie's in France, the filmmaker stayed in a small hotel owned by Dominic Riseborough. Riseborough showed director John Glenn a butterfly act, which Glenn decided to use in the film. But first, he had to convince the rest of the production team. Anthony Way remembers the first time he witnessed the act.
We had a wonderful dinner, and after dinner, he gave us a demonstration of this butterfly and the firefly act. Because he did this butterfly act on fishing poles, he needed a lot of space. So the only place we could do it was in the garden. And by the time we got out there, it was absolutely pouring with rain, really throwing it down. And we all sat out there in the garden with napkins over our heads in the pouring rain while he did this demonstration, which of course wasn't very good because the rain didn't help. But it was pretty impressive. And we were soaked, absolutely soaked to the skin, because he was in the dry operating these things. And when we shot it, the act was then fixed and choreographed to work for the film. And that was at Pete Lamont's set in the studios, the restaurant in the Eiffel Tower. And of course, it's a very clever act. Quite difficult to get on film, but it worked very well, I think.
Carol Ashby, who plays the whistling girl, remembers filming the scene.
We start shooting, and everything's going smoothly. I'm whistling, the butterflies are flying, it's all looking marvellous. Suddenly, there's shrieking going on backstage, and there's a row going on, half in French and half in English. And John goes, cut, 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 what is going on back there? You know, we're trying to shoot here. What's going on? So we've got Dominic and his wife, who come from backstage, and they're peering round. And said, excuse me, he said, I'm sorry, she was doing it wrong, you know. So, well, just okay, fine, let's finish, you know, this first take, and then we'll do another take. Can you be... Well, basically, the butterflies were on fishing lines, like massive fishing rods. So when I was whistling, it looked like I was controlling the butterflies, and they were flying freely. But in actual fact, Dominic and his wife backstage had these fishing lines and moving them about and making them hover and shimmer. Clearly, maybe they've got their lines crossed or something. And basically, they were fighting about, A, who should do it, and there's ructions going on backstage. And there's me in the front trying to pretend there's nothing's going on, and trying to whistle, which of course I couldn't do, and they dubbed me in the end. So that was my leading role in View to a Kill.
And I, Achille Aubergine, intend to fight it.
Paris location manager Serge Taboul recalls his reaction when he first read the Eiffel Tower scene in the script.
When I read this, this Eiffel Tower sequence, I thought that was great to read, and I have no idea how it could be made or authorized. I mean, both, but first authorized and then made. And then that's the great thing with on these Bond films, is everything is possible. It's possible, and especially it's not just an idea. It's possible because you have people who think of practicality in this, how it can be done in this, and once you go through this process, you see that it's finally a very simple thing to do.
Taboul worked closely with the Eiffel Tower administration.
It's a big organization, this Eiffel Tower. The lifts are very old lifts. They work certain hours, certain way, and we had, obviously, we could not shoot a film there, climbing up our equipment top of this, so the what we had to arrange was for the people operating the lift to work after hours and have all this for us. So it was a big, they really helped a lot, and it was something big.
B.J. Wirth performs the parachute stunt, as Michael Wilson recalls.
B.J. Wirth, when he was jumping off, needed a little more clearance, so he didn't want to get hung up on the side of the Eiffel Tower when he jumped off, so he needed to get out a way, so he took up a diving board, and so he just went out a little bit.
French stunt driver Rémy Julien, a Bond veteran since For Your Eyes Only, arranged the chase scene in Paris. Serge Taboul remembers the scene.
The car chase, I think we shot it in a week, if not more, because we could not obviously stop the traffic on this road, which is on the riverbank, continuously, so we had to split it, and we've done it in several factions. The person in charge of this was Rémy Julien, or the stunt coordinator, who was everywhere for this, and he had drivers, and one of his son was one of the drivers there. it seemed in my memory like something pretty easy to do, because it was so well planned and organized.
B.J. Wirth first worked on a James Bond film when he and his partner Jake Lombard doubled for Jaws and 007 in the pre-credits of Moonraker. Wirth has gone on to work on several Bond films, but still recalls the special challenges posed by the parachute jumps for A View to a Kill.
When we shot the Eiffel Tower sequence, we kept the actual jump from the tower for the last part of the sequence, or last part we actually filmed, just in case there might have been any problems. And we ended up shooting the landing on the boat first. And Mark Wolf's helicopter pilot would fly me over the boat, and we'd have the boat parked underneath one bridge, and I would jump out with a radio on. And I would get down to 500 feet, then I would yell action over the radio, and the boat would take off. And we had a time that it would take 30 seconds for the boat to be halfway between the two bridges. And I would circle around and try to make a vertical landing on the boat. And there was many factors involved, because we had this current of the river going one way, the boat going another way. We had the wind going quartering across the bow of the boat, then the speed of my parachute. So we had four different factors of moving, and I just had to concentrate on the landing point on the boat and ignore all the other factors. And as long as I concentrated on the point where I was going to land, it worked out pretty well.
May I remind you that this operation was to be conducted discreetly. All it took was...
Besides being a very fine actor, Patrick McNee is also a producer and considered one of the pioneers of Canadian television. McNee also has a long history with Roger Moore, as he recalls here.
Well, I've known Roger, you see, since 1953. I knew him. We used to go and work out. He was an understudy in a play with Robert Morley in the West End. And we went to a gym off Cambridge Circus, which was run by a little man called Dave Crowley, who was a flyweight champion at one time. And he taught us, we went there to build our bodies up. And there was another actor called Larry Skickney, who you may have heard of, who became Larry Harvey, who was the nicest of all of us. But he took us there, and he became the movie star. He was a big movie star. And we worked out, and so I knew him then. Then I went to Hollywood in the mid-50s, and the first person I met was Roger. We were going up to the same part, and we played brothers in some Scots thing or other. And then I met him on the went back in Old Compton Street, and I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm going to do a thing called The Saint. And I said, oh, that's nice. And then I didn't see him. Then I became a television star, which is a very odd thing to be, you know. It's quite different from being a movie star. But we were all right for television. Now, Roger was too handsome, really, for television, but he did The Saint and became a big, big star. And I think they wanted him for Bond early on. But I used to see him quite a lot. During this time, we kept Elstree alive. People kept saying to us, oh, you'll have to move out when we get a feature in here, you know, and they put us on the back lot at Elstree. And us two television shows, there were only two, The Saint and The Avengers, kept this studio open for 5 years. There was never, to my knowledge, a feature that came in and did anything at all. We were very proud of ourselves. But I knew him very well then. Then suddenly, at the end of the war, he said, what are you going to do? At the end of the session with these two television shows. And he, of course, had plans. He always had plans. It was so right. I didn't have plans, so I just sort of ended up and went abroad. But the main thing is that shortly after that, I met him in Hollywood, and he was playing Sherlock Holmes, and somebody sent me up for Dr. Watson, and I played Dr. Watson with him.
Patrick Bouchot portrays Max Zorin's sidekick, Scarpine. Bouchot's father served in the Belgian underground in World War II. His mother, a Russian, ran a publishing house and a Swiss finishing school. Bouchot speaks seven languages, allowing him to act in films produced on several continents. The location at Chantilly was unique, as John Glenn recalls.
Of course, we had a location at Chantilly in France. And it's a renowned horse racing area. There's lots of stables there. It's the equivalent, I suppose, of Newmarket. And the actual Palace of Chantilly is the 14th or 15th century. Absolutely immaculate condition, surrounded by a lake. And the moment I saw it, I knew we were going to have to use it. While I was there looking at the palace, I said, what's that building over there? It was an equally magnificent building. And they said, oh, that's the stable block. And apparently the Duke who built the palace was convinced he would be reincarnated as a donkey in a future life. So he built the stables befitting a duke who became a donkey. So there was the donkey in the stables together with 50 or so racehorses. It was an absolutely wonderful place. We used that for the auction.
Alison Doody plays Jenny Flex. After appearing in A View to a Kill, she went on to star opposite Sean Connery and Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. When John Glenn was tapped to direct his first Bond film, For Your Eyes Only, Peter Lamont was chosen to be production designer. Lamont had been a draftsman, set dresser, and art director on many 007 films, beginning with 1964's Goldfinger. Peter Lamont recalls shooting on location at Chantilly.
We did use one or two rooms within the chateau, especially the staircase at the entrance, and one or two of the corridors, but the other rooms where Bond debugs the room and where the corridor where he eventually meets Christopher Walken and comes up, and there's this thing where he's in Mayday's bed, and that was all in the studio. But we tried to kind of echo what was at Chantilly.
Like Ian Fleming's James Bond, Patrick McNee is a graduate of Eton. McNee met 007's creator during World War II when he was commissioned into the Royal Navy. He served with the 8th Gunboat Flotilla in the English Channel until the war's end, when he began working in motion pictures. Patrick McNee comments on this scene where Bond and Tibbet search for surveillance bugs in their room.
I love the fact of bugs. People are bugging each other, have been doing it since the telephone was invented. All the time. They know all about each other. This is what I hate about today. Everybody knows too much about everybody else. But the bug scene was so funny because that was a really genuine thing that one knows in the Secret Service. You never have a conversation where it means anything. In any room, anywhere, you only speak to another person way outside in a park or by a lake or something.
Two of McNee's co-stars on The Avengers went on to make appearances in James Bond films, Honor Blackman in Goldfinger and Diana Rigg in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. His co-star in the 1970s series, The New Avengers, Joanna Lumley, had appeared in Majesty's. Publicist Jerry Giroux recalls travelling with McNee on a publicity tour to promote A View to a Kill.
Most of the people who worked on the Bond films over the years, one of my favourites was Patrick McNee. A great character, a marvellous, marvellous personality. We had great fun together. We did a tour of Germany, Australia. We were all over the world. And it was a very funny thing. We went to Munich. We were met at the airport, and we had to go in the town. And this helicopter picked us up, and we went in. It was unbelievable. There's a great tower there that's owned by BMW, and this helicopter did this 360-degree turn around, literally on its side. And we're sweating bullets, and we got down. And Patrick said, Jerry, I never would have done that in 100 years if you hadn't wanted to. I said, what do you mean if I hadn't wanted to? I only did it because I thought you wanted to. So we often laughed about that, but that's my main memory of Patrick, that we almost bought it together.
Production designer Peter Lamont, who has since won an Academy Award for his work on Titanic, recalls the area surrounding Chantilly.
I'd never been to that kind of neck of the woods outside Paris, but the forests there were just full of these sand tracks where the horses galloped. I believe there were thousands of horses within that area around the Chantilly, you know, kind of racecourse.
In the film, Max Zorin tells James Bond that Chantilly dates back to the 16th century. In fact, it was built in the 18th. Peter Lamont remembers filming the lawn party.
It was a great location, and I remember, you know, the kind of the garden party outside. Bollinger did supply a lot of champagne, and they did that huge thing with the bottles, and the people from Bollinger came up and actually erected it for us, which was great.
Over the years, many contests have been held to select people to appear in small parts in the 007 films. A View to a Kill, with its lavish costumed garden party, provided a prime opportunity to bring some of the contest winners to the set, as co-screenwriter and co-producer Michael Wilson recalls.
Well, in the sequence, there were lots of extras. We all had to be dressed up, and we want a very good-looking crowd. we had waiters dressed up in wigs and a livery, and it was meant to be quite a party. And mountains of food that was all prepared by our great caterers. Of course, that's a good opportunity for what we call our contest winners in various locations around the world. But from one of the earlier Bond films, there'll be contests, and some women will be chosen to appear in the next Bond film. So we brought out several of these. They usually come from South America and Europe, and they are in the sequences.
Michael Wilson graduated from college as an electrical engineer, but then switched into the study of law at Stanford University. After graduating, he joined a prestigious Washington, D.C. and New York City law firm, where he specialized in international taxation. Wilson joined Danjak S.A. in a legal administrative capacity in 1972. In the years following, he worked closely with Cubby Broccoli in the preparation of the Bond films. Michael Wilson talks about his progression through the ranks.
I had been executive producer on Moonraker and then the next two films. And when we got to this film, Cubby had said, well, why don't you just be the co-producer with me? I think it was an evolving relationship I had with Cubby. You know, I was his stepson, and I had been a legal advisor, business affairs advisor in the company. And then I got into doing more and more on the productions, and then starting to work with Dick in the writing and also doing the production work. There was no dramatic moment. It just sort of evolved into being a co-producer.
Collaborating with veteran screenwriter Richard Maybaum, Michael Wilson co-wrote the screenplays for Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, and License to Kill. Tanya Roberts remembers Wilson's involvement.
Michael Wilson wrote, along with Richard Maybaum, the script, and he was very hands-on, too. He was there through, you know, the whole production and pre-production. Very sweet and friendly. We met his kids and his wife, and it was just a very tight kind of a family. Everyone in the family was very involved in it, including Barbara, of course, who grew up doing, you know, I guess she started as a runner. I mean, something really to learn her way, and now, of course, she's producing them. It was a real family operation. It was great.
Dr. Carl Morton, at your service.
Hi, Doc.
Good afternoon, Mr. Conley. Mr. Conley, Mr. Schmeich.
Bob Conley.
Actor Willoughby Gray portrays Dr. Carl Mortner. Fans of the Hammer horror films will recognize Gray as Dr. Riley in the 1959 remake of The Mummy. After A View to a Kill, he went on to play the King in 1987's The Princess Bride. Actress Carol Ashby shares her memories of Michael Wilson.
Michael Wilson is the strong, silent man behind it all. From a distance, he was always the guy that you think he's got it all under control, you know. Michael is like that. He's a lovely man, a very kind man, and he's the same kind of personality in that way. But he comes over as a strong, silent man behind there. He's obviously got the child in him too, which is great. Hence, you need to, for the Bond, you've got to have that touch of magic and that sort of, almost that childish touch. It's everyone's escapism, isn't it, really?
Mr. Zorin, it's a great pleasure.
Carl, one of the grooms asked if you go to the stables.
Of course.
You will excuse me?
I must congratulate you, Mr. Zorin. Your stables are magnificent.
Built in the 16th century by a duke who believed he'd be reincarnated as a horse. Have you been interested in thoroughbreds long?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, I had a rather dotty old aunt die and leave me some stables, so I thought it might be rather fun to breed and raise horses. I take it you ride.
Throughout the years, the Bond films have tended to keep the same crew members from film to film, which helps foster a feeling of a family atmosphere, as Carol Ashby recalls.
They tend to keep their crew and their families, and it's a very nice feeling. When I went back the second time to do View to a Kill, it was like going back to school or going back to university again. I'd arrived there and it would be the same crew, the same sort of pranks, and oh no, we thought we got rid of you. Here she is, she's back. It's a lovely banter, nice camaraderie as well.
Hello. I thought you might like to join the party. By the way, the name is James...
Here we see Tanya Roberts as Stacey Sutton. Roberts appeared in several off-Broadway productions before moving to California in 1980, where she was soon cast in the popular TV series Charlie's Angels. Roberts remembers the location shooting at Shantee.
Oh, it was gorgeous, and the stables were so beautiful, and I'm a horse freak because I grew up with horses. And used to go in the Canadian National Exhibition maiden jumping, so when I saw those stables, because I thought I had seen nice stables, these stables were like oak paneled with brass. The floors in the stables were like, you know, the New York restaurants when you see the tiny little tiles. It was just amazingly beautiful, amazingly beautiful.
Oh, by the way, you didn't
Location say... manager Serge Taboul recalls Chantilly.
Chantilly was a very specific place. It's kind of privately owned museum. I mean, they have just incredible work of art there. And it's a kind of place which I would never thought of as a location for a Bond film. The thing in Chantilly, on top of this, is that you have the chateau, but you have the former stables, and you have all those monuments which you see in the film. So it's just like a city next to Paris, first dedicated to horse racing, and at the same time, coming from another world. It all comes from the 18th century.
Given his history with racehorses, Patrick McNee had no qualms about being cast as a racehorse trainer in A View to a Kill. The role also provided the actor with an opportunity to follow in his father's footsteps, as McNee recalls.
I was cast as a trainer of horses. Now, my dad was a racehorse trainer. He was a very famous racehorse trainer, Shrimp McNee, his name was. And he trained before the war and up until the war. At Lambourne, and was considered one of the best judges of horse going. And so consequently, the first question that Michael Wilson asked me, and are you good with horses? I said, well, what do you mean? I can ride them. I used to be a stuntman on wagon train and then rawhide later. I was a riding extra who took falls. Were you? My goodness me. Well, so you're good with horses. Well, you mean their hooves, their fetlocks? Well, that's what I really mean. You don't mind being kicked. I said, well, no, not really. And I'll go in the boxes with them. Fine, I'm good with horses.
These scenes inside the stables were shot at Pinewood Studios. Since the stable floor descends into a secret room below, a two-story set had to be constructed. John Glenn remembers working on the set.
One of the scenes, the horse has to be doctored, shall we say, and is wearing a bandage and so forth. And we chose this racehorse, a beautiful animal. Its owner said, well, it's not much of a racehorse, but it's a better actor. So we had high hopes. He certainly was a very placid animal. And we had an elevated set, which means that it was not on the floor, it was up high. And we had a constructor, an elevator, to take this horse 8 feet off the ground. And our worry, our concern was that the horse would suddenly go ballistic halfway through moving it and kick the place to pieces, which they had been known to do. But this horse had a very good temperament, and he was loved and stroked by all and sundry, and he was enjoying the attention. The strangest thing was that he was indeed a very good actor, this horse, because the moment we put a bandage on its front leg and put a bit of makeup blood on it, the horse really acted to be sick. It really felt sorry for itself. It hung its head, and everyone was saying, oh, you poor thing, you know. He really got into the part.
Ancient drawings show that horse racing is at least 3,000 years old, although thoroughbred racing is a modern development. Almost every thoroughbred in training today can trace its lineage back to one of three horses that arrived in England around 1728 from the Near East. Now Michael Wilson talks about the origins of the ideas in A View to a Kill.
We thought that would kind of be fun, kind of another one of those crazy ideas out of some genetic engineering from the days of the Second World War in Germany. These sort of perfect people were produced. In James Bond's world, it's not impossible. So Mayday and Zorn were these pair of counterparts, if you like, from this experiment.
That small needle is triggered by a remote control transmitter.
At the time of A View to a Kill's release, there were many news reports about steroid use in athletic competition. This, too, provided a backdrop for the plot of the film. Once James Bond and Tibbet leave the horse stalls, they enter a Zorin factory. These scenes were filmed when Renault automobiles were manufactured, as Patrick McNee recalls.
That factory is just outside a place called Swindon, which is very close to where I was brought up. And the whole of that factory, I may be exaggerating, as I always do, but basically there are only two human beings in that factory. It's all run by robots. Well, I've done two Avengers, you know, they're called the Cybernauts. wonderful, way, way ahead of all this. But now that factory is run by robots, and Roger and I worked in it. We didn't really realize it at the time, but it's the most chilling place.
Special effects supervisor John Richardson also remembers shooting at the factory, where his crew had to rig the box-crating machinery on the conveyor belt that is featured in the fight.
We used that because Peter Lamont liked the look of the factory, and it was very sort of modern-looking and a, you know, good conveyor line. And then we built our own, you know, bits of machinery for the various gags and for where people had to get smashed in it or trapped in it or chewed up in it.
Richard Maybaum was born in New York City in 1909. He attended the University of Iowa, then set off on a career as a playwright. In the late 1930s, Maybaum moved to Hollywood, where he became a screenwriter and producer. In 1946, he produced OSS, an Alan Ladd spy thriller. Maybaum and Ladd again collaborated on The Great Gatsby in 1949. When Ladd was approached by Cubby Broccoli to star in the 1953 war film The Red Beret, Ladd asked Maybaum to write the script. Michael Wilson recalls his own writing collaborations with Richard Maybaum.
Well, Dick Maybaum and I, we'd worked on three films. Altogether, we wrote five films before he passed away in 1991. We followed basically the same style every time, the same working relationship. Very often we would work together at evolving ideas and kicking them around. And then we might work on an outline, and one of us might write it, hand pages off to the other one. The other one would rewrite it, and it would get passed back and forth like that. When we got around to actually writing the script, we'd talk about the sequence, and sometimes he had a better handle on it than I had. Sometimes I felt a little more excited about it than he did. So whoever seemed to be the most interested in the sequence would try it first. And then we'd sit down and go over it, and then the other person would rewrite it. Sometimes when we were in a hurry, we'd sort of leapfrog over each other to push ahead and get the script out.
Tape ran out 5 minutes ago. Good night.
Maybaum was one of several writers who contributed to the script for Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent. Just as shooting began on A View to a Kill, tragedy struck when the 007 stage, which was meant to be used for Peter Lamont's huge mindset, burned down. At the time of the fire, the stage was being used to shoot Legend, a fantasy film directed by Ridley Scott. Associate producer Tom Pevsner remembers the fire.
They burned down the stage, and there wasn't a lot we could do about it except rebuild it. And Cavi moved very quickly, and fortunately the builder, the constructor, who had built the stage was still around, still doing Pinewood's work. And I think he had the plans of the original stage, so it was just a matter of very quickly telling the insurance company that they would either be into a huge claim if they didn't agree to rebuilding the stage, and they would be into a fairly sizable claim if we did rebuild the stage. So they moved very quickly on that. We rebuilt the stage. Peter was started building the set on the stage before the stage was actually fully roofed. And we did what we could in postponing, you know, shooting what we could before getting onto that sequence. We did run out of work. I think we had a hiatus of about 4 weeks while they finished building the stage and the set on it. We were able to keep to a reasonable delivery date, thanks to the speed with which Michael Brown rebuilt the stage.
Advances in technology allowed the new 007 stage to be constructed with less manpower than the old one. Co-screenwriter and co-producer Michael Wilson remembers seeing the new stage go up.
When we built the original 007 stage in 1975 and 76, technology had not caught up in England in the construction industry, and we had hundreds of workmen, laborers, putting up this building. When we came in 1984 to reconstruct it after the fire, I was surprised to see the equipment rolled in to just tear the place apart and clean the site. They used huge pieces of earth-moving and demolition equipment with a single operator inside. It would tear everything down and grind it up, quite amazing machines. After they cleared the site, they brought in machines with workmen that were like elevators, and they just lift up sides, and it was never more than about 20 workers on site at one time. It was absolutely amazing to see what a great revolution had taken place in the building industry in England.
New York-born actor Christopher Walken was 15 years old when he saw Dr. No. Just 7 years later, Walken made his film debut acting opposite 007 star Sean Connery in the Anderson tapes. After a memorable appearance in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, Walken co-starred with Robert De Niro in The Deer Hunter, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. A View to a Kill's director of photography was Alan Hume. Tanya Roberts remembers Hume.
He was very good. Made everybody look terrific. That's the first thing they told me when I came to do the movie is, don't worry, every woman in our movies looks gorgeous. Which wasn't something I asked in particular, but that was the first words out of their mouths. So I suppose a lot of people had asked that in the past. And it's true, the lighting was spectacular.
We have several horses that might interest you.
Splendid.
Alan Hume was the cinematographer of many carry-on films in the 1960s. His first James Bond was 1981's For Your Eyes Only. Hume then went on to shoot Octopussy and A View to a Kill, and also shot the Star Wars film Return of the Jedi.
I think I have just the horse for you. It's time for my morning ride. Why don't you try him out?
It sounds a very good idea.
I shall get into some riding first.
Good.
Half an hour then. Scorpion will collect you.
Thank you.
As the script for A View to a Kill was finalized, it became apparent that a number of horses and French riders would be needed for the scene where Zorin tries to kill Bond during a steeplechase. Production supervisor Tony Way remembers one scouting trip to Chantilly.
The area around there is famous for the horse racing, horse riding, and of course the training rides. And they have these fantastic rides through the forests. Miles and miles and miles of these specially laid tracks with deep, fairly deep sand. And we were told that every morning, about 6:30 in the morning, 150 horsemen would come through, and it was quite a sight to be seen. And I remember we humped out through this dripping forest 6:00 one morning and stood at this, beside this track, and everybody dying for coffee, and it was absolutely gorgeous. Cuckoos were singing and birds were singing, and nothing happened. Nothing happened, and then about 25 horsemen came around the corner, and that was it. It was fairly tame. We had an audition to choose riding doubles, and of course we'd seen all these guys on horses, fabulous, do all this over jumps, and these giant horses. These guys turned up in the evening, and they were all like 4'6" high and tremendously bandy legs. So when they were dressed up in the costume of the actors, it looked quite funny.
The Rolls-Royce featured in this sequence belonged to co-producer Cubby Broccoli. Broccoli's personal license plate read Cub 1, spelled C-U-B, and the numeral 1. Patrick McNee recalls filming his demise in the Rolls-Royce, a scene which left the actor with a lasting phobia.
I've never been able to go into a car wash since. You know, that I don't think there are many car washes now where you stay in the car when you go through the wash. It's one of the most chilling experiences to go through a car wash and somebody behind there and you are then garrotted, which is a wonderful word anyway.
In shooting action scenes, the work is sometimes divided between the first and second units. The first unit films the shots with the principal actors, while the second unit films shots using stunt doubles. This allows the production to remain on schedule by having more than one unit shooting at a time. John Glenn recalls coordinating the units shooting the steeplechase scene.
We did lots of scenes with the horses and that in the woods, and then of course we had the scene where they tried to ride Bond to death on the horse. And Arthur Worcester, my second unit director, shot a great deal of that, and he used extensive rigs to film it. with very good effect.
And if I'm thrown, then you lose.
Arthur Worcester had shot second unit scenes involving horses before on Octopussy. He would go on to shoot more horse action in The Living Daylights. Worcester remembers filming the steeplechase scene in A View to a Kill.
I love horses. I ride myself and hunt, and I love them. They have a mind of their own. Well-trained horses can be very easy to work with if they're really well-trained, and you've got the right riders on board, and they love the camera. If you're on a tracking vehicle and you've got a horse galloping up, he'll try and jump you. I mean, they come right up to the... I mean, you don't have any problems with them coming near to you once they get used to it. And again, with helicopters, the first time you start a helicopter up near a horse, you'll run a mile. But if you do it gently and you start it up and you quietly bring it closer and bring it closer, we've done shots where we've had horses right up on top of the helicopter. If you work it slowly and gently and keep on bringing them up. I like working with horses.
The art department also contributed to the action of the steeplechase scene, as production designer Peter Lamont recalls.
That was done in Shanty. There was an area there that we did some extra fences and that type of stuff. The whole Shanty area is just full of these sand tracks going through forest, and there was this area where we did this kind of steeplechase bit. We actually did the fences where they were leaping around. I think Arthur Worcester shot it, as I remember.
Stunt coordinator Martin Grace used several French stuntmen in the steeplechase scene, which was filmed at Chantilly, as he recalls.
I had a basic team of doubles that were British. Because we had locations in France, we had a French stunt team as well, and a stunt team in the United States, so we actually had three different teams to deal with. The French obviously knew their home territory very well, and the horses were from a French source, and it was good that we could employ the French stuntmen, you know.
To be starred in a film usually means that an actor's name appears on a single title card in the credit sequence. Although Patrick McNee has only a supporting role in A View to a Kill, he was delighted to find himself receiving star billing, as he recalls here.
I was not starred in this extremely small part at all. I was just in it. Even though I was ex-Avengers, both of my leading ladies had become big, big stars as a result of being in two Bond films, Diana Rigg and Honor Blackman. But I did my little part, and rather well, actually. And about 4 months later, when the film came out, I was starred in that film. I'm on one, Patrick McNee. Entirely because of that Cubby Broccoli. He thought he may have had a small part, but he did it well. I'm going to star him. I'll never forget him for that.
The shots of Mayday pushing the car into the lake were filmed back in England and were achieved by use of a cable that pulls the Rolls-Royce into the lake. John Glenn remembers the scene, which marks the end of Patrick McNee's character in the film.
So that was the end of poor Patrick, but not before he'd given us very good service playing the chauffeur to Roger Moore and driving this beautiful old Rolls-Royce, which happened incidentally to belong to Cubby Broccoli. It wasn't, I hasten to add, the one that was pushed into the lake. That was another one that we did up to look the same, but it didn't have an engine. And another one of my boyhood fantasies came out there, which was breathing from the tyre underwater. He stays alive, breathing, letting the tyre down slowly with his finger. It's possible to do, apparently, so I was told on good authority.
Production designer Peter Lamont remembers filming the tricky scene on location at a gravel pit near Raysbury.
Obviously, where Patrick McNee gets killed from the car wash, and his the car is then rolled away into the gravel pit. That was done here in England, but we wanted a Rolls-Royce that was elegant, and obviously Cubby's was the kind of the real choice. And what we did, we got a second one, so we could actually use Cub 1 as the real car, and then we had the other car for the one that went into the water at Raysbury.
The shots of the car underwater were filmed at Pinewood, as John Richardson recalls.
Once it was underwater, we cut to a tank on the stage in the studio, and we had, you know, tyres prepared and gags prepared for Roger to be able to breathe air from a thing, or at least appear to be breathing air. But if you practiced at it, you could actually go down and, you know, put your lips around the tyre valve and take air from it. And we used pure air, obviously, so, you know, Roger was fine with it.
If you look closely at the next scene, you'll spot Dolph Lundgren. Lundgren was dating Grace Jones at the time. The film's unit photographer submitted photos of him to United Artists, who were casting Rocky IV. Lundgren won the role and soon embarked on an acting career. Michael Wilson remembers Dolph Lundgren.
Dolph was an interesting character. He was a kickbox champion, and he was a fellow who was hanging around with her, and they were getting on quite well. But he had ambitions to be in the film business as an actor, so we gave him a chance to do it, and he has a small part in there where he plays one of the henchmen at the racetrack.
Shooting all of the scenes for the second half of the film, which takes place mostly in San Francisco, required enormous coordination, as co-producer Michael Wilson remembers.
We had five units photographing in San Francisco. We had not only the first unit doing the regular filming with the actors, the second unit doing the fire engine chase, working at nights. We had an aerial unit doing the blimp that we had at the and then working up on top of the Golden Gate Bridge. We had a plate unit, and we had a special effects unit doing special effects shots as well. And those would work. We were there a little over 2 weeks on the main unit, and during that time we worked. We had the production office open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because at that time, every moment of the day and night, we had a unit working in the field somewhere. In San Francisco, the mayor was Dianne Feinstein, who is now United States Senator, has been for the last 8 years, and from California. And she was a real help. She was very gung-ho and loved the idea of promoting San Francisco. And she was wonderful to work with.
In the unique position to form an international cartel to control not only...
One of the most famous earthquakes of all time was the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. On one of the early location recces to California, John Glenn went to an earthquake research center located in Orange County, south of Los Angeles, as he recalls.
Initially, we were very interested in the earthquake situation in California. And we went down to an earthquake research center in Orange County and had lunch with an expert. And we took him for lunch. And the first thing I noticed was that he was wearing one red sock and one black sock, which I didn't know was significant or not. It was interesting in his conversation. He said with all his technical knowledge, he still found the best indicator of an earthquake likely to happen was if he looked in the lost and found columns and found lots of adverts about cats missing from home, people appealing for people to return their cats. And he said, they always build up before a major earthquake. So the animals know something, you see. So much for the scientific data. But they have these listening posts, shall we say, all over California, where it all goes to a central place, which happened to be where we were, which gives them any ground movements. It even detects if a cow walks past it, it even shows up on their seismograph. So very sensitive equipment. And this was the background to our script in the end, that we came up with this scheme where Zorin takes advantage of the critical situation on the fort and in fact promotes an earthquake by flooding below ground in an area that's very critical to try and corner the microchip market, I believe, which was rather similar to, I suppose, Goldfinger, where he wanted to corner the gold market by making the gold radioactive so no one could touch it. So Zorin had then cornered the silicon chip market and equally make a huge fortune.
Construction of the Golden Gate Bridge began on January 5th, 1933. While it was being built, a safety net was rigged underneath the floor of the bridge from end to end. The net saved the lives of 19 men who became known as the Halfway to Hell Club. Martin Grace remembers working on the bridge.
On the Golden Gate Bridge, they have a lift to take service people up there. Obviously, that has to be painted from time to time. And I remember the first time I got in the lift with the operator, only two other people could travel with the operator. And if you had a bag, you had to carry it above your head because there wasn't space. But it took a while to get the people we needed up there, which was quite minimal, really, the operator and doubles. But we did go up there, and my first experience was when I walked out the top was
I thought I'd go straight up there and I'm going to go straight down that pipe, that cylinder, you know, which I did. So we had a stunt girl who had done some circus work, but she'd never been that high. And I thought, well, if she needs confidence, you know, and that's, you often need to give that to even stunt people. And if they see that you are doing it quite easily and relaxed, then it makes them feel relaxed.
The Golden Gate Bridge has always been painted orange vermilion, which is also called International Orange. Painting the bridge, which is necessary to protect it from the high salt content in the air which rusts the steel components, is an ongoing job. Special effects supervisor John Richardson remembers filming background plates on top of the bridge.
We had to go up in this horrendously claustrophobic little lift that was about 2 foot square and took 7 minutes to get from the bottom of the tower to the top. And then you get out at the top through a little hatch and you were 746 feet in the air. And then you had to walk about 75 feet down one of the main cables, which of course is sloping, and set up a VistaVision camera looking in all sorts of different directions to shoot with the necessary plates. That really tested one's fear of heights, but it also, you know, gave us the, you know, perfect plates to match in, you know, everything with the airship.
The total length of the Golden Gate suspension span is 1.2 miles. The two main towers are 500 feet above the roadway, 746 feet above the water. Here's John Richardson.
First time I popped out was certainly the most interesting because you've been in a lift which is incredibly claustrophobic. There were three of us jammed in this lift, which was the maximum you could get. And in fact, we were so compressed in there that when we got to the top, none of us could move enough to open the door handle to get out. We're all trying to, you know, jockey round for position to get somebody's hand free to actually grab the handle and open the door. And then you get out of there and you go along a little dark sort of alley and up a little vertical staircase, and then you come to this hatch and you throw the hatch open. And as you pop your head out, you've got the whole world outside. I mean, it's like 360 degrees of horizon. You're literally going from one, you know, sort of screamingly close environment into that. I went up there with one guy one day who did suffer from, you know, altitude problems, and I watched his eyes as he came up through the hatch, and I mean, he was terrified, and I could really sympathize. After you've been up there all day, hang out a bit, and you get used to it, and it's not so bad, but that first time, it really blows you back.
Securing permission to shoot on the bridge was not easy. The bridge's manager nixed the idea, but the bridge board overruled him in a 10-2 vote. Eon Productions paid the standard fee for the use of the bridge. Tom Pevsner recalls the challenges.
The difficulty was the bridge, because the bridge didn't come under the city administration. The bridge was an independent authority. And they were very unhappy, mainly because they have a history of when anything goes wrong on the bridge, some bright spark sues them for whatever it is that you get sued for if you own a bridge. And they were very nervous about us doing stuff on there and distracting motorists' attention and causing an accident for which they would then be sued. And we had to reduce our requirements enormously and get it down to an absolute minimum, which was a second unit, not even a second unit. I think we had John Richardson, who was in charge of the special effects, and I think a cameraman and two stunt doubles. And we had 2 days on which they were able to clamber about at the top on the wiring of the bridge, and I think then we, at the end of the location, we threw the dummy off the bridge. And they were persuaded with difficulty, but persuaded eventually they were, and we had to do an awful lot of patching. We built the bridge on the lot. We built sections of the bridge on a fairly large scale, 4-to-1, with a balloon attached to it. We built sections of the bridge on the lot full size. We did sections on the stage. It was a real sort of jigsaw puzzle to get round the fact that we had very limited facilities on the real location.
This scene on Zorin's oil rig was shot at Pinewood with a bit of special effects magic, courtesy of special effects supervisor John Richardson and his crew, as he recalls here.
That whole underwater sequence, particularly the stuff with the pipe and the big giant propeller that Bond jams his scuba tank into, we shot on the stage at Pinewood, where we constructed a tank that was, I think it was about 16 feet deep. The impeller was a giant impeller that we built without any pitch on it, so that it could revolve without sucking or pushing the water to any great degree. We created the look of the water flow with hoses and air bubbles, and the impeller we could control going round pretty safely so that we could have Roger close to it. The air tank being jammed in it, again, was a dummy tank and an air explosion underwater. I think we used, flash bulbs and all sorts of other gadgets and gimmicks under there, but it was all, pretty much our stock effects gear.
Creating such exciting predicaments for James Bond requires careful planning and cooperation between all of the departments. Production designer Peter Lamont recalls working on the scene with special effects supervisor John Richardson.
We did it on A stage, as we had a tank that we had filtered water, and we used the Rolls Royce in there, and also did the pipe and all that, the impeller, that type of stuff. Normally the stunt department would always come to us, and ask for handholds, footholds, or whatever, or restraints, the big thing is to be able to talk together and look for a problem before it occurs. If they're going to do it, and we'll provide anything that we can.
Fiona Fullerton was born in Kaduna, Nigeria. After playing Anastasia in the 1971 film Nicholas and Alexandra, Fullerton became a sensation in a musical version of Alice in Wonderland, featuring music by frequent James Bond collaborators John Barry and Don Black. For years afterwards, Fullerton was cast in innocent girl roles, until landing a part in A View to a Kill helped her change her image, as she recalls.
I got the role, I think it was the summer of 1984. I was summoned to Cubby Broccoli's office. I think it was in an Audley Square in London. My agent rang and said they wanted to see me about a role in the new Bond movie. And I was so shocked, so surprised, because really up until that point in my career, I had always played the ingenue, sort of the sweet young thing, the goody two-shoes. I was everybody's daughter in every movie and television series, and always had this very, very wholesome image. And therefore, being asked to go along to meet the great Cubby Broccoli to be in a Bond movie was so exciting, I can't tell you. And very, very alarming. I was ushered into this office, and there seemed to be lots and lots of people sitting there. And I remember distinctly that John Glenn was sitting on my left. And I'm afraid I flirted outrageously with him. But I'm sure there were lots of other people in the room, so it's okay. This is such an extraordinary myth to be a part of, that I was really just so thrilled to be sitting there. And of course, when I got the role, it changed my whole career to a huge degree.
The shots of Fullerton emerging from the Pacific Ocean were shot on location in California after she had filmed her hot tub scene with Roger Moore at Pinewood Studios. Fullerton remembers shooting the scene in the hot tub.
The atmosphere on the set on my first day was fantastically relaxed, and everybody does tend to make you feel extremely welcome. And I think I knew several of the guys on the crew. I'm sure I had worked with some of them before. So that sort of helped, because they all seemed delighted to see me there. I think they were just looking forward to me taking my dressing gown off. I don't know. But when I got into the tub, I remember the wardrobe mistress holding my dressing gown around my shoulders, and so I sort of shimmied into the water.
so that nobody could see anything. And of course, once I was under the bubbles, I felt very protected and safe because you really couldn't see anything.
Fullerton recalls working with Roger Moore.
Roger just has this fantastically spontaneous sense of humour and just made it very easy for me by just cracking me up all the time. And I do tend to giggle a lot, and he quite liked that. So we got on absolutely fine from the word go. Then when we'd finished filming the jacuzzi scene in the studio, we all decamped to San Francisco.
Dianne Feinstein was the mayor of San Francisco in 1978. Associate producer Tom Pevner recalls how Feinstein facilitated the filming in San Francisco.
Most of the preparation of the Bonds is done in London. But during the scripting, Michael and Barbara and Covey were in Los Angeles, and I think they must have set up the first contacts with Dianne Feinstein, who was then mayor of San Francisco, and got her fairly fired up. I think she was very enthusiastic for us to shoot there.
Walter Gotell appears in these scenes as General Gogol, a role he originated in The Spy Who Loved Me and played in a total of 6 James Bond films. A native of Ireland, Gotell was fluent in both German and Spanish. He appeared in over 45 motion pictures, including such classics as The African Queen, Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much, and The Guns of Navarone.
Main strikes in 3 days. Any delays, I hold you responsible. It's essential. The remaining pipelines are open on time.
Daniel Benzali, who plays W.G. Howe in A View to a Kill, would go on to gain fame as Theodore Hoffman in the American television series Murder One. Director John Glenn recalls working with Benzali.
We cast Daniel Benzali. We cast him as the mayor, I guess, or the man in charge of the Ministry of Mines, or whatever you call it in America. He eventually comes to a sticky end. He's in the pay of Zorin, apparently. So the fire sequence in the lift shaft was kind of major to do.
Benzali was born in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in 1950. On the London stage, he played the part of Argentine President Juan Perón in Evita. A View to a Kill was only his 3rd film role. The actor has now appeared in over 24 films and has made numerous television appearances. Portions of the City Hall scenes were shot on location, but most of the interiors were filmed on recreations of the hallways, offices, and lift shaft at Pinewood Studios. Tonya Roberts recalls filming in San Francisco.
San Francisco was great because, you know, we love it. We went and we met the mayor at City Hall. It was really nice to shoot there. It was nice because we could fly back to L.A. a lot.
Charles Jerry Giraud was United Artists Director of European Publicity and Advertising with Production and Distribution when Dr. No was produced in 1962. By the 1970s, he was an integral part of the James Bond team, heavily involved in all aspects of each film's publicity. Giraud recalls being on location in San Francisco.
I always enjoyed being on location in San Francisco, having been born there and spent a lot of my youth there. It was great fun to be there in a totally different capacity, involved with a major motion picture, to be staying in one of the very finest hotels in town, to be feted and everything that was going on, to be with the lady mayor, Dianne Feinstein, who is now, of course, a very famous American senator, and to be treated every sense of the word royally, and to see and to do what we did with the City Hall where it was being burned down, to me was great fun. I enjoyed every second of my stay in San Francisco. It was quite unique for me.
Product placement is a way for a film to gain exposure in return for using a product or showing a brand name in the movie. An example of product placement in A View to a Kill is James Bond's Sharper Image credit card, which unlocks windows. Michael Wilson comments on the scene.
We do have some product placements in the films where we have a relationship with a company. It's mainly involves us having a joint publicity campaign at the time of the opening. And I think with Sharper Image, Roger was on the cover of their catalog, and they had some devices that we used.
The scenes at Stacey's home were filmed at Dunsmuir House and Gardens Historic Estate in Oakland, a 37-room colonial revival mansion. Michael Wilson remembers the location.
The house we used for Stacey's house was one of the historical houses in Oakland. And it was used by one of the... It was one of the early Oakland families. It was now it's a historical monument.
Purchased by the City of Oakland in the 1950s, Dunsmuir House is surrounded by 40 acres of lush gardens. During the summer months, it is a popular site for jazz concerts and cultural celebrations. For the Bond crew, it proved an ideal location, as John Glenn recalls.
One of our locations was in Oakland. It was the house that that Tanya inherited. It used to belong to her grandfather. In fact, the grandfather's ashes turned out to be in a vase in the sitting room. I think that the house itself was absolutely magnificent. It was owned by an old railway millionaire or billionaire years ago. A beautifully proportioned house, made mainly of wood, clapboard style, with large balconies running round. And it was perfect for us. It was fairly empty, which was what we wanted, because she couldn't really afford to furnish it. She'd inherited the house and she desperately wanted to keep it. She'd been done out of her inheritance by some scam, and that was the basic reason she joined forces with Bond. And people there were, it's now a museum, the house, and the people there were very cooperative with us and very helpful. It was a great location, very sinister at times.
When Dr. No had a sneak preview at the Kensington Odeon in London prior to its release in 1962, United Artists Director of European Publicity Charles Jerry Giroux flew to London with the UA head of production Bud Ornstein. The two men stood in the back of the theatre with producers Harry Saltzman and Albert R. Broccoli to gauge the audience's reaction to the film. The audience, as Giroux recalled 37 years later, went absolutely berserk. Giroux recalls the relationships, both personal and professional, on the Bond films.
One of the interesting things about working on the Bonds over the years, it's very much a family operation, literally and figuratively. Those of us that worked on it, whatever one's position, you became part of an extended family. But within that, there was also the Broccoli family, who were people who all had something to contribute. They weren't there because of some degree of largesse on the part of Cubby, who gave all to whom all. This was something where people worked because they had something to contribute. And it was marvelous to be around and to be part of. And I feel honored to have been as close to the center of operations as I was without being a member of the Broccoli family, but at the same time, very much feeling as if I were. And I still do to this day. I only have a few
leftovers in the fridge. Tanya Roberts also has very fond memories of the man who was a guiding force behind James Bond and an inspiration to all who worked on the films, Albert R. Cubby Broccoli.
Yeah, Cubby was like a big bear. He was very, very sweet, and his daughter Barbara were fantastic, and he was just very hands-on. And as I said, first class, everything was great. I mean, we'd actually have linen tablecloths for lunch. And, you know, if you ever go to a set, you don't see silver and linen tablecloths. And guys, chefs with the hats on, and it was very elegant. And as I said before, everything you'd want, need or want anything, they'd get it for you. It was really enough to spoil you for life. Incredibly generous, took us to great clubs and restaurants, and Dana Broccoli was great as well, and would invite us to his house, and just really warm, really nice guy, and wouldn't spare, you know, getting us anything we might need from just anything, anything that would make us comfortable, on top of which all the locations were phenomenal, all the hotels were phenomenal. It was just a really great experience.
So Zarin sent along his gorillas to help you make up your mind.
They have.
After playing one of Octopussy's girls in Octopussy, Carol Ashby went on an all-around-the-world tour to promote the film. In Sydney, Australia, she attended a party where members of Duran Duran were among the guests. The band, who had scored top hits with songs like Hungry Like a Wolf and The Reflex, told Ashby how much they would like to record a 007 theme song. Ashby passed on the band's eagerness to Barbara Broccoli, daughter of 007 producer Cubby Broccoli. Cubby also encountered one of the band members, Andy Taylor, at a party, and Taylor reiterated his desire to do a Bond theme. So when A View to a Kill came along, the band members recorded the only 007 theme song to reach the number one position on the pop charts. Carol Ashby shares her memories of Cubby Broccoli.
Cubby was wonderful. I mean, Cubby was like my sort of second father. I suppose he must be second father to everybody because everybody feels that, you know, he's part of them. He was wonderful. He was very, very kind to me. And when I did my first Bond movie, he sent myself and Mary Stavin out to America and sent us to drama workshops there because he thought we had potential. What a brave man. He had faith in me. It was nice. And I remember saying when I'd finished the courses and whatever, which I really learned an awful lot from, gave me tremendous confidence, and just out in Los Angeles. And I just said to him one day, I said, Cubby, how can I ever thank you for what you've done for me? I mean, he was always doing things for everybody, but for me anyway, I just wanted to say, you know, how can I ever repay you? And he said, you know, it works like this, Carol, said, at some point in your life, you'll find or meet people that need your help, and then you give them help. So you just pass it on, and that's how life works. And I never forget that, and he had a wonderful philosophy. He was very much a people's person, very hands-on. I wasn't actually there at this point, but apparently there's problems with some of the caterers and the chef and the cooks and hadn't turned up on the set or whatever. And Cubby just turned around and said, right, okay, where are the pans, let's get the pasta. And he cooked for everybody. He embraced everybody, and, well, for me, I'm so pleased I met him. He was great, and we had fun together. Lovely sense of humor.
Let's see what the Earthquake Center has on it. Just a minor tremor.
A View to a Kill takes its title, but little else, from Ian Fleming's short story, From a View to a Kill, which is one of five short stories that appears in the book For Your Eyes Only. Published in 1960, the book of short stories were adapted from ideas Fleming had sketched out for a possible James Bond television series. When the series failed to materialize, he adapted the ideas into short stories. Three of the stories have titles that have not been used for 007 films: Quantum of Solace, Risiko, and the Hildebrand Rarity. In the short story From a View to a Kill, James Bond investigates the murder of a NATO dispatch rider who is shot in the back while driving a motorcycle from headquarters in Versailles to Saint-Germain. Bond gathers clues, then disguises himself as a dispatch rider and drives a motorcycle down the same road. When the assassin attempts to kill him, Bond breaks the bike and skids around to shoot him. He kills the man, then rides back to the underground Russian hideout, whose entrance is disguised by a fake rosebush that splits in half. Agents from Station F arrive to help Bond attack the spies in the hideout.
Be more specific about Zarin's intentions before I go to the top.
David Yip found filming his death scene at the Dunsmuir House in Oakland challenging, as he recalls here.
Just thinking back, talking about this beautiful house in the location. Okay, as I said, we shot the exteriors. The interiors were, they rebuilt it in London. But I die outside this house. And when we shot it on location, Grace Jones's character kills me. And I mean, I have to get in this Jeep, and I have to, yes, she comes behind me and strangles me. Now, Grace wasn't there. Grace Jones wasn't there on when I was on location. So they had a stand-in lady. And so we played around, and she strangled me about 22 times, and she was very gentle, you know, she was all right, very fine. And eventually that was done. But part of the reason I had to come back from LA was that they rang and they said, look, we've looked at the stuff, and actually we've got to see Grace Jones's face, because when they were shooting with the exo, the other lady, the stand-in, you know, they obviously hid her face. They said, no, we've got to see, you know, Glenn wants sort of her face to come up. So we had to shoot it in London. And She did it three times, and she nearly killed me each one. whereas the Stanley Lee was very gentle, and saying, no, grab his neck, grab his neck. Grace Jones, who was, she's extraordinary. I mean, she is a big woman, very tall woman, and the first time she saw me, she just tapped me on the head and said, you're cute. and we got this setup going in London, and suddenly they said, action. And suddenly I thought, my life was going to disappear. This woman grabbed me around the neck. We did it three times. I don't think I could have done a fourth. I wouldn't be sitting here.
The authorities in San Francisco gave the James Bond production unprecedented cooperation. Not only did they allow City Hall to be set ablaze, they also rerouted traffic to allow filming on the Golden Gate Bridge and allowed the second unit to spend nearly 4 weeks shooting a chase scene at night on city streets. In appreciation, co-producer Cubby Broccoli insisted on having the film's premiere in the city. Here's actor David Yip.
Well, talking of City Hall, of course, one of the extraordinary things is they set light to it, or seemingly set light to it. And I remember, because I, while they were setting up, I took a walk around. It's a beautiful building. And outside, they had fire engine, had all these things ready. I mean, for the film itself, but also ready. And I technically assume they must have put some sort of bonfire-type things on top of things, but it looked incredible. And I remember just, as a member of the public, and there was huge crowds watching it from outside, I just thought, wow, as they lit this thing up. I suppose now they wouldn't do that. It'd all be done on a computer effect afterwards, but there were actually flames up there, and you get thinking, well, I can't see anywhere else in the world. I mean, they certainly wouldn't come to London and light up the Guildhall or whatever. I think they wouldn't let them set fire to it, but that's the power of the Bonds. I think they get where no one else goes, and they film on the Eiffel Tower or San Francisco Bridge or whatever. Although I went back later and shot a documentary on San Francisco Bridge. but they set the trend. Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, one of the great things I love, and this is what goes back to what I say before, I think acting is a wonderful job, and I pinch myself sometimes that actually I am an actor and people pay me to do this job. But there's something about night filming, you know, when it's dark outside and somebody, they strike up these arc lights. And, you know, when they were shooting that, it was dark and everything. And you think, oh, my God, this is amazing. You know, we're making a Bond movie. Exciting. You know, I'm a child. I think most actors are a child at heart. And actually, I still get that buzz. I think if I didn't get the buzz, then it's time to pack up and go grow vegetables.
David Yip had some apprehension about playing an American. But when he arrived in San Francisco, he saw that his stand-in was a young American actor. The stand-in helped him practice his lines, and as a result, Yip was able to give a very convincing portrayal. David Yip remembers his excitement upon being cast.
They called me in and said, you know, we're setting up View to a Kill. Would you be interested in being in it? We all got a Bond film. Of course I'd love to be in it. But then they said, we're thinking of you for this CIA man, Chuck Lee, and I'm not sure how many British people have paid the CIA man. So it was, I was quite amazed, and they said, would you be interested? Would you like to do it? And I said, I'd love to do it. But I was a little bit worried, thinking the idea of going to America, and it was my first time to go to America to play an American, but that's how I got it. I met Cubby, and we talked, and John Glenn, and it was very nice, because actually, again, I said, I'd only done one major movie beforehand, a lot of some television, and I was quite frightened when I went in, but they were so nice. And I think this is a theme which has come through a lot of things, people talking about Bond films. The Cubby Broccoli family and the Eon family, the people who make the Bonds, it is a very family, you get a great family feel. So when I went into this interview, I sat there and within minutes, they'd made me feel at home and whatever. And it was only my own nerves when they started talking about playing in America and that made me think, wow. And then they offered me the job there and then, and I came out, the office wasn't in Piccadilly yet, it was in, it wasn't where it is now. I came out and I was sort of, I remember stopping and thinking, I'm going to be in a Bond film. Extraordinary. And sort of walking on a cloud. And it was only later I started to panic about, God, I'm going to play an American now.
The fire sequence inside the elevator shaft was filmed at Pinewood Studios on a set that recreated the interior of San Francisco City Hall. Director John Glenn recalls shooting the scene.
The fire sequence in the lift shaft was quite a major to do, and I must say that Tanya was fantastic. She was very, very brave. I mean, although it was controlled and we had all the firefighting people, it was a lift shaft. And once she was out on the beams above the elevator,
It was a very, very hazardous operation. Always is. Fire is always difficult to work with. But again, John Richards is an expert with fire, and the trick is to make it fierce enough to be effective visually, but at the same time not take any risks with the actor. So we succeeded in that sequence. But fire is a difficult thing to work with, and I'm not particularly crazy about working with fire, I must say.
As a former Charlie's Angel, Tanya Roberts was accustomed to dangerous situations, but the fire in the elevator shaft was particularly risky. Tanya Roberts recalls filming the scene.
In the elevator shaft, and I don't have a fear of heights, I'm very athletic and physical, so I don't have problems with that, but in the elevator shaft it was a little scary because there was a fire, but it wasn't near enough for us to hurt us, but it was still, you know, kind of gives you, you know, a feeling that you want to get out of the elevator shaft, which was the idea of the scene, so it worked.
James, don't leave me!
Special effects supervisor John Richardson had his work cut out in setting San Francisco City Hall ablaze, as he recalls here.
Filming City Hall, or the burning of City Hall, posed a vast number of challenges. I believe Dianne Feinstein was the mayor at the time. I can remember on the first scout, you know, we stopped and looked at it, and John Glenn said to me, well, you know, what do you think's the best way to do it? And I said, well, you know, let's make it look as though it's on fire. You know, we don't need to do a miniature of it. I think we can do it for real. As long as we can convince everybody to let us do it. And they were great. They were, you know, incredibly helpful. The local fire department were, you know, superb, and they gave us all the backing and help. And we got some giant ground flares manufactured in Tennessee that, you know, give off an incredible sort of flickering white, yellow light and a lot of smoke. And the idea was that we put those up on the roof, which give it that sort of incandescent glow that you get from a building on fire. And then with, you know, propane gas piped in, smoke carefully positioned, and, you know, all those other film gags. We had a fire up there that you could literally, you know, sort of turn on and off. And so I think we got the whole scene in one night.
With careful planning, John Richardson and his special effects crew were able to pull off the fire sequence without any damage to the building, as Richardson recalls.
We did that one using all small propane tanks because of the logistics of getting them up and down on the roof and across the roof when we get up there. We probably had 30-pound tanks, which is about 1,500 pounds of propane. If you position it in the right place and control it properly, then, you know, it can actually look a lot more than it is.
A View to a Kill was only the second 007 film that John Richardson had worked on, but director John Glenn had full confidence in his special effects supervisor.
We knew what we were doing, and in John Richardson we had one of the world's greatest experts on fake fires, if you like. You know, he had every device in the book, you know, which would make it look that the City Hall was well alight, which it did. The fire chief also was on side. He was a great character and had great faith in us. And it's one thing I must say about the Americans, they really embrace film crews. And, you know, if it brings dollars into the city, as it does, you know, we spent several million dollars in San Francisco, it does wonders for the local economy, and they're very conscious of that. And so they gave us fantastic cooperation, and the fire crews as well. We used all their engines, and fortunately we weren't too far from the fire station. So if there was a real fire they had to put out, we could just switch all our gas off, and they could go about their normal business. But They were great characters, and I always remember that Tanya Roberts had to be carried down one of the ladders, one of the turntables, and these guys were fighting amongst themselves to get the opportunity to be the ones that carried Tanya Roberts down. good fun. And Mayor Feinstein was wonderful. Cooperation was great, and we didn't do too much damage to the fire to the city hall. I think one of the fire hoses broke a window and flooded the tax office or something, which everyone was pleased about.
Remy Julien's driving team again contributed to the film with the fire engine chase through the streets of San Francisco. Using a specially equipped fire engine, Julien and his crew, under the supervision of second unit director Arthur Worcester, created a scene both exciting and humorous, as John Glenn recalls.
We developed a scene with a lot of humor, which, you know, you could liken to the early days of the cinema, really, Harold Lloyd and the spectacular things they used to do, you know. It's basic visual humor, which doesn't need translated into any language. Everyone can see it immediately. There, again, is one of the essential ingredients of the Bond to be international. You know, if you can be humorous with your pictures, you know, it saves translation, and humor doesn't always translate very well, but visual humor translates instantly, so it's the best humor you can have.
Glenn appreciated the official help.
The police were very cooperative, and you know, we, in fact, we were going to be waking up the neighborhood, was got over by using the less densely populated areas and asking permissions in a nice way ahead of time, and restricted to certain areas. Yeah, it was a very successful shoot, and the results were stunning, I thought.
One of the film's most remarkable stunts is the fire engine leap across the bridge. John Glenn remembers the scene.
Remy Julien had become an integral part of the Bond team by this time. I'd used him on For Your Eyes Only, and every film after that, it was always Remy. We didn't ask anybody else, because this guy is a scientist when it comes to doing stunts. I mean, it's not left to chance. It's all rehearsed beforehand in France on his airfield there, and he does all his truck leaps and things, and then stopwatch and photographs it. He knows exactly what's going to happen. He weighs everything. It's a science. And he's, without a doubt, one of the world's experts, and employs a big team. And done some fabulous work for the Bonds.
To film much of the chase, Glenn relied on his second unit director, Arthur Worcester.
Arthur Worcester was given the task of shooting a lot of the night material of the fire engines, racing around the streets with Bond on the swinging arm of the ladder as it swung out and narrowly missed buildings and took the top of a caravan at one stage. Very difficult thing to organize, and Arthur did it very well. And from that material, we were able to insert in the studio Roger Moore and Tanya inside the fire engine where they make their escape.
Glenn was impressed by the workings of the cantilevered bridge.
Some of the engineering you find in the world is quite amazing. I mean, this bridge, which is cantilevered, it has these huge weights, concrete weights on either end, and the actual engine that drives the bridge, that actually raises the bridge, is tiny. It's like a, you know, a quarter of a horsepower motor or something. The thing is so finely balanced. However, you know, the fact that we had a car on it rather changed everything, and I think that it caused a few problems in terms of balance, because we had police cars sliding down the bridge, and when it was at this, you know, uppermost, if you like, and that was exciting stuff. I mean, we wrote off about six or seven different cars, you know, which we were all doubling for the police cars, and I think there's just something very humorous about police cars being wrecked. I think people enjoy it. I don't know why, but they do.
Rigging camera platforms on the bridge when it was at its highest level posed special problems for the second unit crew. Arthur Worcester remembers how his team, including camera grip Ken Atherfold, overcame the challenges.
That was a heavy shoot. We had an enormous crew because we had to double up with American crew. Kenny was with me, my English grip, and he did all the rigs on the fire engine. I remember distinctly them on the bridge, because the bridge goes up, and we had cameras right at the top of it. And I said to Kenny, well, they can stick something up there, you know, and he said, hold on, Governor. And he built a proper rig, and I must say that when we finally got up there and we were doing the shots, and that bridge goes up and you're up top there, I was so glad he did, because it was just a straight drop down. We had three cameras at the top, and operating those cameras, and the police cars, they come up, and they virtually, and one stops right at the top and teeters, if you remember. But that was a lot of rig work on that one, a lot of heavy rig work for the grips and special effects by it.
Peter Lamont designed the set for the main strike mine to be built inside the 007 stage at Pinewood. When the stage burned down, he was forced to reconsider. Fortunately, Michael Brown and Delta Doric, who had built the original 007 stage, were able to put up a new stage very quickly. Meanwhile, Lamont put up the set in sections on smaller stages. Lamont talks about the challenges of designing the set for the main strike mine.
If you do something first time, I find it's much better than if you suddenly start working at it. And I came up with this idea and showed it to John and everybody, and they said, oh yeah, that's great, let's do it. And that's the way we did it. You know, it's sometimes it's that first idea of how I saw it. You know, we'd had a lot of tours around the various institutes around San Francisco, you know, with obviously their institutes who deal with the faults and that type of thing, and we had to make it seem plausible that it might act in the right way. Somewhere on the fault, you know, there's a big cavern there, and I'm not sure if we ever put steam into it, but there was just this kind of suggestion that something went beyond. It wasn't just a hole, that it was part of the fault. And you know, when you're up there, when we went on our first record, we did do a helicopter trip around the North Tower, and then we picked up the fault where it comes up out of the bay, or the kind of the mouth of the bay, and then you trace it down, and it's quite amazing, but it's visible. You know, it's not an invisible thing. Everybody knows where the fault is, you know, and I believe out in the desert, you can actually see where there are the various levels, you know.
What's stopping him?
It's a good idea of yours. Pity you couldn't find one that fits.
The exteriors of the main strike mine were shot at the Amberley Chalk Pits Museum, which is located in Sussex, very near Arundel. An industrial open-air working museum, it was established in 1979 and covers an area of about 36 acres. The site proved ideal for the James Bond film crew, convincingly substituting for California. Peter Lamont remembers filming at the unique location.
We went down there mainly because of a mine entrance. We wanted this kind of mine area that they had the equipment, the little train and that type of stuff. The actual hole into the chalk pit mine wasn't terribly long, but the main thing was it gave us the chance to build something in the studio. We rented rails from them. We rented the engine and all the trucks and this type of stuff, had it back in the studio. And we actually, when we built the set, the idea at that time, it was going to be built composite with the whole mine, and we were going to flood it. But of course, as you know, the 07 stage got burnt down, and we're in the throes then of rebuilding it. As we started to run out of sets, we had to revise it. And I remember that part of the set, where the explosive is going down into the mine before they explode it. We built it on D stage. We had our kind of mine kind of galleries built in a kind of huge horseshoe, but we actually continued the little miniature railway lines in a full circle. So instead of backing up every time, we could just drive around and come back to the start point. And that all matched up with what we had down at the Chalk Pit Museum. And then we built a kind of office that Zorin had down there, and we also then took the real airship down there. It came down for I think a couple of days, and then I think back in the studio we then shot the model of the when Zorin and everybody goes into the office. The next thing is the sides fall out and the whole thing inflates, and the airship takes off.
After fire destroyed the 007 stage, Peter Lamont had to change the way he was going to achieve the flood, which comes near the film's climax, as he recalls here.
before the stage got burnt down, the whole concept was that we were going to build a huge water reservoir in the stage so that we could actually flood the mine real for real. And of course, as when the fire came, that we had this problem. We weren't allowed to build under the new structure going up. We'd got models of everything that we were going to build. As we were building from the back, we were building the kind of the main chamber, and then it was only way, way down at this end, the south end, that we were going to build the tunnels. So as we couldn't, and we were starting to build down on A stage and also D stage, and we actually formed a kind of complete loop with our little miniature railway that went round. So in effect, nothing ever had to back up. Once you've done the shot, you just went round, you just went back to the start mark. And our idea was that we would flood it real for real. If we had sufficient water, we could actually do it. But of course, as time went on, we had to revise our ideas. The pieces that we flooded, we put down on A stage, where we would flood it in a controlled manner. We would also flood the main one eventually. There had to be water up there, obviously. But the main kind of waterworks was done with the miniature. The bigger scale you can get with water, it's much better, because you get is that scale that you miss. And of course, you have to shoot it about four times over speed.
He'll kill millions. These green lights, they're Zorn's oil wells. The ones he's been using to pump seawater into the Hayward Fault.
What are these tunnels for under these lips?
These lead straight into this section of the San Andreas Fault. You know, Zorn just has to blast through the bottom of these lakes to flood the fault.
On the James Bond films, nothing is considered impossible to achieve, but when the filmmakers had to convincingly drain a lake, it required careful planning and ingenuity. John Glenn comments on how the effect was achieved.
To get the effect of the lake above, which drains because all the water floods into the mine, and we sat around the production office with Peter Lamont and tried to discuss a whole number of experts how we were going to achieve this. Someone said they'd seen a dry reservoir. There was a drought on in England at the time. We'd seen a dry reservoir in Wales, all cracks and things, and would that do? And I said, well, not really. And I said, it suddenly came to me. I said, well, what about one of the estuaries, the tidal estuaries in the West Country where you get big tides? You know, we can film it when it's wet, and then we wait 12 hours and then film it when it's dry, when the tide's gone out. And they said, oh, it's worth a try. I sent Arthur Worcester down to the West Country because he knows it quite well. He has a boat at Salcombe. And he came back with his location and it worked absolutely perfectly. And we just did a tank of pinewood here. We shot a scene of the fisherman in the boat. 1 minute he was fishing with water there, and the next minute he's beached, and the fish are flopping around on the ground, you know. So a combination of those two locations, we achieved the result with very little money, really. It's a very inexpensive operation, considering the scale of the thing.
Get them back to work!
All right, you men, get back to work! Come on, it's all over, get back to work!
It's Bond. Close up the entrance, nobody gets out.
Special effects supervisor John Richardson set charges in the lake to give the impression of blasts going off in the main strike mine underneath. He recalls working out the scene.
We shot the draining lake in the sea just off South Sea on the south coast, where there is a fairly strong tide. So we shot the explosions going off and the little man in the boat at high tide, and we shot the drain lake at low tide. And I don't think anybody ever missed the fact that you don't see it happen in between. Magic in the movies.
All of these interior mine shots were filmed on location at Pinewood Studios. Special effects men are able to command the elements at will, or at least able to convincingly fake them. creating a major flood scene for A View to a Kill, special effects supervisor John Richardson relied upon several methods, as he explains.
All of our water rigs involved, giant tip tanks and lots of hoses and pumps and flooding mechanisms. So again, we have to work very carefully together, because if we're throwing 10 tons of water down a chute, we've got to make sure that everybody's in the right place when it comes out at the end. And this is, another area where stunts and special effects have to coordinate very carefully to make sure that everybody is safe. Also, we had a big miniature of the mine, which we used for the main flooding.
And my men.
Yeah, a convenient coincidence.
Mr. Zorn, those men are loyal to you.
Stunt coordinator Martin Grace had his hands full arranging stunts for the flood sequence. Grace had received a painful injury on Octopussy when his hip was shattered while he was doubling bombed hanging off a train. Luckily, he recovered from his injuries and was back on A View to a Kill, both coordinating and performing stunts. Martin Grace remembers the flood scene.
Well, the mine flood was like a series of mines. We had, it was an elaborate sort of maze of tunnels that had, we had tip tanks set up in various places where they would give the best effects. And there was, some of the tunnels were running vertical and some were running horizontal. So we had situations with people actually dropping down with the water, and we had situations where people were being carried along. And often I would place people up in the roof area, because it often confuses that you need to see bodies. And often if people are just on the ground and water comes, they get engulfed in water, you see nothing more. But if you have people above and drop them in into the frame, into the shot as it's coming, it looked much more spectacular.
John Richardson recalls how the shots were achieved.
There was one scene where they wanted to see the water level coming up in a cavern, and they wanted to see it, visibly on film, which means it's got to come up in 5 seconds or something. So we just built the roof of the cavern and lowered that into the tank. It's quicker and easier.
In these scenes, we see model shots and shots filmed on the full-size stage intercut seamlessly to give a convincing impression of a massive flood in a confined space. John Richardson talks about the effects.
The flowing water, which I believe is where Tanya Roberts and Grace Jones are having their little battle going up the ladder trying to escape from the flood. We had the usual, set and the tank and the water, and then the flowing water was in fact controlled with fire hoses and jets positioned just above and just below the water surface, which give the impression that there's a torrent there, but in fact it's just a spray.
To show bullets striking surfaces, several methods may be used. Sometimes charges are placed in the objects. Sometimes compressed air guns are used to shoot plastic capsules filled with dust or sparking material. John Richardson explains the methods used to show bullets hitting the water.
It was the usual sort of difficult sequence, bullet hit-wise, because it involved water. And whenever you've got water, and you've got bullet hits in the water, and you've got people close by, you have to be, really careful, because if you're using charges, you've got to be absolutely certain where the charges are and that they're not getting too wet, and that you haven't got people close to them. A lot of that stuff you can do by firing ball bearings or marbles into the water. The old marble gun technique is very good, because it's very quick and easy to load, and if you've got a whole unit and actors and everybody standing around, you don't want to be using a system that takes 3 hours to set the bullet hits, because nobody's going to want to wait for it. So we try to, in those situations, mix up the different hits, so that we'll put some spark hits in which will show up visibly, we'll use some marble gun balls in the background which will give the splashes, and then we'll put a few close ones in the foreground and hopefully make it look like a million bullet hits. But I say everybody doesn't have to wait all day while you rig it.
The Zorin office, whose walls fall away to reveal the cabin of an airship, is a model. The climax of A View to a Kill posed several challenges for the effects and model crews of the film, who had to create several versions of the Zorin airship in different sizes and constructed of different materials. For some shots of the airship, it is a model hung from a crane. For others, it is a scaled-down airship controlled by tethers from the ground. Special effects supervisor John Richardson recalls working with the various airships.
A little model building with a real inflatable blimp inside it. We had a number of different size model blimps. We had a 3 foot long one, we had a 20 foot long one, and then we had a 40 foot long one that we could actually fill with helium and it would fly. We built it on exactly the same principle as the real airship. The difficulty with it was that inside those airships there are curtains which are sort of stitched into the fabric, which have to be tensioned so that the dirigible holds its shape. What was difficult for us was that to get the thing inflated, we had to fill it full of helium, which of course you can't breathe. And then I remember crawling through a 3 foot tube to get into the blimp with an underwater diving mask on and demand valve to breathe air while we laced up all the curtains inside. It's a very uncomfortable, claustrophobic feeling, because I say you had to get in through this little plastic tube that was about 10 feet long so that the helium didn't escape, and try and remember that you couldn't breathe the air although you were surrounded by it.
The greatest cataclysm in history.
And all attributed to natural causes.
Grace Jones was such a presence in the film that the teaser ad campaign eventually highlighted her character, with posters of Mayday and Bond standing back to back, and the tagline, "Has James Bond finally met his match?" Now Tanya Roberts recalls working with the airships on A View to a Kill.
It wasn't the actual Zeppelin. Where the scene took place was the carriage under the Zeppelin, which is actually a very small compartment. The actual area where the reporters and the people sit is quite small. But it was so beautiful. I mean, if you've ever flown in like a Learjet and you compare it to flying on a commercial airline, it's like just handles everything in the air. It just slips and slides. This is the way this was. It was just incredibly streamlined and very beautiful, white, and it was just great looking.
Come on, come on. Okay, hold it there. Take it up!
Get on!
It's too heavy, go!
Get on, damn it!
Okay, go!
Director John Glenn recalled some of the scouting trips made by the production team when they were investigating potential airships for use in the filming of A View to a Kill.
A major prop in the film, of course, was Zorin's airship. We had the full cooperation of airship industries that manufacture these airships. We went over to this huge hangar in Bedfordshire where they house these enormous airships. The same hangar they used to use for the R-101 and all the old British airships they made of it many years ago.
Easy. Gently. Right. Lower.
Since A View to a Kill, Grace Jones has continued to make appearances in films such as Vamp and the Eddie Murphy comedy Boomerang. Now, as we near the finale of A View to a Kill, we are about to see Mayday come to an untimely end, as John Richardson recalls.
Mayday blowing up was live action that we shot down at Amberley chalk pits on the south coast of England. and we rigged up a small cart, railway cart, with a dummy that matched Grace. And we buried in the ground underneath the track a fairly heavy high explosive charge. Get exactly what it was, but it was probably some ammonium nitrate based explosive. We hauled the cart along at the appropriate speed, timed it so that the charge went off when the dummy and the cart were right over the top of it, and blew the hell out of everything.
For shots of the real airship in flight over the Amberley Chalk Pits Museum, the craft was piloted by Commander Nick Bennett and Trevor Hunt. For wide shots of Bond hanging from the mooring rope, a dummy was suspended from the rope rather than endangering a stuntman. Production designer Peter Lamont recalls working with the airships.
There were two airships, if you remember. There was one with Zorin's kind of fulcrum. And then there's the one at the end where they're making their escape from the mine.
For shots filmed in San Francisco, Jim Arnott doubles for Bond hanging to the mooring rope of the airship. In fact, Arnott was hanging from underneath a helicopter piloted by Rick Holly, as John Richardson recalls.
We actually rigged up under a helicopter a rope with a parachute harness for the stuntman, so that he could sit in this harness. He even had foot stirrups on wires down his legs. Hang onto the rope, and we flew him out under one helicopter, and we flew behind with the other helicopter, so that we could get sort of close-ups of him with the real Golden Gate, the real bridge, behind him.
Background plates shot by John Richardson in San Francisco were put to good use at Pinewood, allowing the filmmakers to give the illusion of Roger Moore clutching perilously to the actual Golden Gate Bridge. When intercut with shots of stuntmen at the actual location, the end result was flawless, as director John Glenn remembers.
When Zorin's airship takes off and they make their escape after the mine disaster, Bond, all he can do is clutch hold of the trailing rope of the airship as it's leaving. And, of course, he's now suspended beneath the airship and going over San Francisco Bay, just missing the Transamerica, I think, building. Another opportunity for humour, and we got some wonderful shots of the bridge. Not only that, we made good relations with the manager of the Golden Gate Bridge. And at first, of course, he said that he wouldn't allow anyone up on the superstructure. And after a little bit of persuasion, and just purely on a friendly relationship basis, and we explained that we were good filmmakers. We weren't people who were going to embarrass them anyway. We weren't going to drop cameras on the cars below and things like that. We did manage to get shots from the top of the bridge, showing which I could then use later on for where Tanya Roberts is hanging by her fingertips and Bond is saving her from falling below. We were able to do that to get VistaVision plates. VistaVision cameras are very large. And also they saw that we were as good as our word, very safe people. And then we then did a limited fight sequence way aloft there above the traffic. And which gave us a kind of something to hang the sequence on when we got into the studio and we built sections of the bridge. But it was a very worthwhile concession. We got fantastic shots.
Another longtime James Bond veteran, stuntman George Leach, doubles for Dr. Mortner in the action at the film's climax. Stunt coordinator Martin Grace recalls the action in the film's final scenes.
We had a stunt double for Christopher Walken. Often people are arrested for trying to climb on the Golden Gate Bridge. I had the luxury of being allowed to go up there and struggle with the other double.
The wide shots of Bond, Zorin and Stacey atop the Golden Gate Bridge were filmed on a Saturday in October of 1984, with Martin Grace doubling James Bond, Dick Zeiker doubling Zorin, and Karen Price doubling for Stacey. The shots were completed by noon, and the background plates for use in the studio were filmed. Martin Grace is justifiably proud of his work on the scene.
The fight actually on there, I didn't say until now, but I feel that was really a very, very good fight with Roger and Christopher Walken. I've been watching it recently, and it was almost like that they were fighting an impossible situation, because the actual cylinder is only about a meter wide, and on the top there's only about 9 inches or a foot that they were actually could actually keep their feet on. And all the time they were battling to sort of destroy each other, but also they were battling to try and save themselves by holding on to the handrails, and they were getting knocked and slipping and sliding and hanging on, and Bond gets sort of knocked off and he's hanging on the rope. It's all desperate stuff. It's really desperate. And in the end, when Christopher Walken actually goes, when he's hanging on the pipe and he's going to actually die, and he looks down, he actually smiles. It's like, this is really what I want, you know? So I felt that was actually a great fight.
Charles Staffel and Roy Moores were in charge of the front projection on the film. Front projection is a process whereby images shot on location are projected on a screen in the studio, allowing the principal actors to appear as if they are in a dangerous situation. John Glenn recalled Staffel's work.
The most challenging part was I think, the bridge, to make that look authentic, you know, with the restricted access we had to the bridge. Fortunately, we had these plates, which I managed to shoot on VistaVision from the top, you know, which is a huge negative, so we got very good reproduction. And the Charles Staffel, who was the front projection expert at Pinewood, did a fantastic job for us. He made a rig where he had the front projection machine suspended from the ceiling, and we had Roger Moore and Tanya Roberts doing their stuff, where he's holding her by her fingertips, suspended over the traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge, but the screen was on the floor. We had to put safety chains on every part of that piece of equipment because it was so heavy, probably weighed close to 4 tons. And the worst thought was, you know, if you're working away under this rather Heath Robinson type of machinery, that a piece will fall off and come whistling down on you if you're the actors. So we were virtually over the top of the actors while we were doing this, and we had to take extreme precautions to make sure that if anything did fail, that it would fail safe. That was the section of the bridge we shot on the stage at Pinewood. We also had a miniature bridge constructed on the lot where we did a lot of the shots, and we also had a section, full-size section of the bridge on the lot.
I'd like to say a special thanks to all the actors and crew of A View to a Kill who are heard on this audio commentary. John Glenn, Michael Wilson, Tanya Roberts, Fiona Fullerton, Patrick McNee, Carol Ashby, David Yip, Tony Way, Tom Pevsner, Peter Lamont, Arthur Worcester, BJ Wirth, Willie Bogner, Serge Tabool, John Richardson, Martin Grace, and Jerry Giroux. I'd also like to pay tribute to all those who assisted in gathering the material for this commentary, especially Mark Tinkler, Mark Cowan, Lee Pfeiffer, Mark Cerulli, Paul Scrabo, George Ann Muller, Stephen Wax, Ned Hards, John Watton, Doug Smith, Antonio Watson, Dave Worrell, Derek Miller, and the archives of the Ian Fleming Foundation. This audio commentary was compiled by Bruce Civilly and produced by John Cork, Bruce Civilly, and David Naylor. This is David Naylor. Thank you for listening to the audio commentary of A View to a Kill. James Bond will return in the special edition of the living daylights.